My name's Cole Ross.
And I'm Jala Prendes.
And you're listening to a bonus level, kind of continuing our informal, loosely scheduled kind of look at some visual novel type games, talking about Phoenix Wright Ace Attorney. This is your first time playing this, right, Jala?
It is. When I was originally talking about one or another visual novel when I first got into the genre, everybody was like, did you play Phoenix Wright? Have you played Phoenix Wright? Have you played Phoenix Wright? And I'm like, no, I haven't. But I kind of started because when you, to be honest, when you first mentioned the gist of what Phoenix Wright as a premise was, I was not terribly interested in the idea of it. But then when I played Leviathan, the last, Last Day of the Decade, that one, one of their strongest influences was the Phoenix Wright series. And so I was like, well, and then I kept on hearing it pop up in relation to other visual novels as being, you know, really formative to the genre and kind of like the direction that the genre has gone in, you know, kind of incorporating adventure elements and things like that.
Especially with Danganronpa, right? I feel like Danganronpa is an explicit kind of reaction to Phoenix Wright.
Yeah. And especially when I had played Danganronpa and, you know, we had our various discussions about that, I thought that, well, it's about time for me to go ahead and just, you know, wait for a sale and just buy it, especially when it was on the Switch. And I was like, okay, they put it on sale on Switch and that's my current handheld device. So I'm going to get it and play it since it's there. So
nice. Yeah. Like I played this back around the time I first got my DS shortly after it kind of first came here. It was kind of part of that big wave, you know, the DS came out and there was so much invention happening on it. It kind of felt like the Dreamcast or whatever, like, hey, here's a game about fishing where you do some fishing stuff with a special controller. And, you know, the DS had like, here's a game where you're a doctor. Here's a game where you're a surgeon. Here's a game where you are creating rainbows for Kirby to roll along. And then, you know, kind of along with that, you know, so those strange themes, here's a game where you play as an attorney. I was like, okay, cool. Yeah, I'll try this. Not realizing it was going to kind of be like a fun little, reading a manga and doing logic puzzles and stuff, you know,
And in Phoenix Wright is, to be fair, only about half attorney and then half detective.
Yes.
But we'll talk about that as you were saying, though.
No, this is my first my first game that would even approach something like a visual novel. Back when we did a poll for WAF, back when we still did polls, themed to have patrons help us pick, and we did like what we loosely called a visual novel poll. That was the one that 9 hours, 9 person, 9 doors won. And this was on it, and people are like, hey, none of these are really visual novels, they're more like graphic adventures or whatever. People are probably, you know, right, you know, they're people gerrymander and quibble about the taxonomy. This feels very obviously like it is, at least, you know, you could accurately describe it as that, right? As a visual novel kind of thing, especially when it gets going. But yeah, this is my entry into this, you know, kind of like sideloading from graphic adventures, and you know, got me used to playing games that were mostly reading, right?
Yeah, well, I definitely have a strong love of any game that is very story focused, and of course the visual novel type of genre is so text heavy. It's very story driven. And that's part of the reason why that genre appeals to me. So it was interesting doing Phoenix Wright because this is the first visual novel that I've played that is this episodic, because it really is like compartmentalized into, you know, case by case, trial by trial. And yes, there are characters that bleed over from one case to another, but by and large, most of the story is contained into episodes. So That was an interesting thing for me because I didn't know how I'd like that because I like very interwoven complex narratives. And little did I know when I first started playing the very first episode of it that as you keep going, boy do the trials get complex. so then it gave me okay, this trial will never ever ever end. Like the first trial is like 2 seconds, but then none of the rest of them
they're multi-day affairs, and as the series goes on, I think it's safe to say, like, our plan, based on your reaction to Phoenix Wright 1 and the fact that you're continuing to play Phoenix Wright 2, we'll probably do the first three. Let's say we'll probably do the first three, especially the third one is on more of a kind of like meta narrative kind of thing. Not mm-hmm. meta is the wrong word. There's an overarching narrative that is like specifically about Phoenix's past, where it is playing like that. But even within the individual cases, they do get long and tangled, but most of what you're getting is like characterization about these at first broadly sketched kind of figures, and then you get a lot of affection for them. Like, I defy you to leave this without liking Gumshoe, right?
Yeah for sure. So just like a brief overview for anybody who I don't know that there's anybody that would be listening to this who doesn't know what Phoenix Wright is, right? But it is a visual novel that was released in 2001 by Capcom on the Game Boy Advance originally, and then it was later released on DS, Windows, Wii, iOS, Switch, PS4, like everything. Mm-hmm. And in it, you play Phoenix Wright, a defense attorney that basically is trying to prove his various clients innocent by pointing out contradictions in witness testimony and evidence. And his antagonist is Miles Edgeworth, at least in this first game, yeah. Which is a prodigy prosecuting attorney who has never lost a case until now.
until Phoenix comes along. Miles mm-hmm. Edgeworth, very, very uptight, very cocky, very off-putting, becomes lovable kind of over the course of the series. But as of, at the beginning, he is, I knew as soon as I said that you would raise your own objection.
No, I'm not objecting. I am agreeing because yeah. Like, boy, didn't I say something like, who is this stuffed shirt with his cravat? Like, get him off of my screen with his tea drinking and whatever.
He's dressed like a goddamn pirate. Come on. Yeah.
But I really did not like him at all. And everybody's like, no, I love Edgeworth. He's the best. And I'm like, whatever.
they do a lot of work over the series to develop him and thaw him. And a lot of that happens, by the end of this game where you realize he's not that bad of a guy, right? But like mm-hmm. his first impression is not very good.
Something.
Like every case kind of follows a little bit of a similar kind of outline, mm-hmm. which is they're all turnabouts, right? So the idea is, you see the murder happen, who did it, the person is being framed, they're your defendant that you're defending. And then you have to go and then prove how usually somebody who was a witness for the prosecution actually did this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's why, the Japanese name of it, which I do not know, I don't know off the top of my head, but it is.
It's turnabout trial or attorney or something like that. Turnabout something or another.
Yeah. That's a big thing for it. And Phoenix's whole deal is you always believe in your client, and you always turn things around and look outside of the box.
And at least in this game, there's never a time that you are wrong in doing so. Your mm-hmm. client is always legitimately innocent. But yeah. I should go ahead and point this out at the start that we are going to have a spoiler wall. So if you are listening to this and you don't want spoilers for the game, even though it's 20 years old, if you don't want any spoilers for this 20-year-old game, we will let you know before we actually go into the nitty-gritty about the cases themselves.
Yeah.
So right now we're just talking generalities. So mm-hmm. the reason why the turnabout thing is so important to this in general is because the person who created this series, Shu Takumi, was basically given the leeway by his boss, Shinji Mikami, to create any game he wanted within 6 months' time. So he wanted it to be a simple game that even his mom could play. And it was originally going to become a detective game with Phoenix being a private investigator, but he wanted to have the core mechanic be taking apart a testimony and finding contradictions, and that has nothing to do with detective work. So instead, he made Phoenix Wright, who is sort of a detective, sort of an attorney, and that's what you're kind of, you're acting as both, even though that's, I don't think that's actually how it works in Japan. I may be wrong. I don't know their legal system very well, but I'm under the impression probably not.
there are articles and analyses about how this game relates to the Japanese legal system, which sounds like a fucking nightmare. And I'm saying that from America, whose legal system is a fucking nightmare. This is a little bit of a send up and kind of an indictment of the way that they handle specifically guilt. Like if a trial goes to trial in Japan, like it is pretty much guaranteed that the person is going to be found guilty. Because of the way that this, and so the idea that you have this defense lawyer who can actually turn things around is like subversive, or was at the time. I have no idea if that's changed since this came out. I do not think that their lawyers go around messing with crime scenes and keeping evidence secret.
<You know? laughs> but it's all in good fun though. But Takumi, when he was working on this, like he apparently reads a bunch of short stories and stuff, and was highly influenced by a couple of authors, particularly Edogawa Ranpo, who wrote The Psychological Test, which is a short story where a crime was committed and then it all unravels due to contradictions within the criminal's testimony. And so that's where that core mechanic concept came from. And he also wanted to have like surprise and unexpectedness, unexpected things happen, and quoted another author, Shinichi Hoshi's writing. I looked and I could not find anything in English by these two authors. So I do not know that they are something that is accessible for us over in America to read without finding somebody to translate it or finding an online copy or something.
Fan translation or something like that. Yeah.
So do you want to talk a little bit about how the gameplay mechanics work? It's kind of divided into a couple of different modes. There's the investigation portion where you are a private detective, more or less. And then there's the trial where you play lawyer.
So the investigation, it's kind of strange coming back to the first game after, you know, having played many of the later games. The investigation gets more complicated as the as things go, so this seems pretty simple in comparison. It's also kind of the weakest part of this game, I think, the portions where you are going kind of from location to location around the crime scene or kind of in offices for people related to the case, both kind of interviewing people, looking for evidence by examining the scenes, and then presenting pieces of evidence to people to get them to share more information to you. A lot of the times it does the frustrating thing that happens in adventure games where it's like, I know I need to do something to proceed, but I don't know what. Not shown the right thing to the right person? Oftentimes it's like, oh, you should have thought to go back to this place that you thought you had picked over in order to talk to somebody new. Like, this is where it doesn't quite hang together as much as it does during the trials, and this is where it's going to feel the most like an adventure game.
For sure, because there were definitely times when I was playing this game that I'm just like, what am I supposed to do? I know there's something. It's obviously not advancing to the trial, so there's something I'm missing, but what in the world do I have to do? And sometimes it is legitimately, you just have to go through, and like, there's a lot, at least for me, the first time I was going through this, there's a lot of guesswork where you're just like, I'm just going to try this thing and then this thing. And then you have to go through the same text several times. And it can be tedious if you get stuck in that kind of a thing. So what I would recommend for somebody who's going to this game fresh, if you get to something like that and it feels frustrating, just go to a spoiler-free walkthrough and just figure out what the order is that you need for the one thing and then just move on.
Yeah,
because it's not worth the frustration. It's not.
the walkthroughs on Strategy Wiki end up being really good for that a little bit. Mm-hmm. They end up almost being like checklists. You know, don't do that for the trials because those are good and require inventive thinking. Like in the actual investigation portions, figuring out which flag to trip is legitimately frustrating, and you're not missing anything by spoiling that for yourself, I don't think.
Yeah, for sure. Because that's just where it feels the most gamey to me. Like the trials feel a lot more fun because you're doing the logic puzzle phase of the game versus just you have to trip flags in a certain order and you have to talk to this person and do this thing before you go over here, and that's what triggers this person to show up at this place, and that gets pretty chore heavy. So
yeah,
but then you have the trial phases though, and that's really fun. That's when the witnesses will testify and you get to examine evidence and cross-examine the witnesses, and you're trying to figure out what the contradictions are or press them, for like kind of a psychological warfare of like trying to get them to break a sweat under the questioning and say something that'll trip them up.
Yeah, it's like, okay, that was unclear. I know that you're speaking around something. I'm going to press you and force you to elaborate in order to create an opening, to make yourself vulnerable to to presenting evidence.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird that there's a health bar in this.
Yeah, there is a health bar. I was going to mention that. It's kind of funny that there's a health bar. I kind of equate that to in Danganronpa where they have the equivalent of a health bar, but I think they call it like your reputation meter or something like that, where it's just basically how believable you are to everybody else and how persuasive you are, successfully persuasive you are. And that goes down. And if it goes down too far, nobody believes you anymore because you just made too many mistakes. And that's kind of how I equate this, even though, it's legit a health bar with little ticks in it. It highlights what I do think is fun is that it highlights how many ticks of health you will lose if you jack something up. I like that part because it's like, oh, if I make the wrong choice here, 4 health bar ticks are gonna drop. Oh, this is important. Crap. And that kind of puts a bit of pressure on you to get it right, because if they didn't have that there, you wouldn't necessarily be as worried about it because you wouldn't have the visual,
The way that I conceptualize it, it's the judge's patience more than anything. Because you do pull some bullshit and the judge should not let you make the arguments that you make.
There are definitely some times where Phoenix pops off with something and, you as a player and Phoenix as a character, you do not know what you're doing, but you are raising an objection anyway and coming up with something out of left field.
Yeah.
And eventually, if you keep running with it, you end up coming out with, something workable, but you don't really know what you're doing. You're kind of go flying by the seat of your pants. I believe that's the expression I'm looking for.
Yeah. You just with your wing, bluffing, right? Yeah. And it's like, I don't have anything, but I need to pretend that I am long enough to hope that somebody says something that I can grab onto is kind of his entire strategy as a lawyer. And it always remains that. And that's good because the trials need to be dramatic, right?
Mm-hmm.
The testimonies are presented, statement by statement. Oftentimes it will appear like, hey, there's nothing wrong here. This is where it gets really fun because you dive into your court record and you look at all of your evidence, and there may be small little details that are not explicitly called attention to that you have to kind of make a note of. So like something about the cause of death, they'll say, oh, this, I found this guy and there was a bunch of blood everywhere. Just as an example, that's not an actual thing. And then you look at it and you say, well, the cause of death was blunt trauma. Why would there be that much blood for this? That doesn't add up. Right. Mm-hmm. And then that starts new testimony on and on, as either characters decide, oh yeah, I didn't see what I thought I saw, or as the actual culprit, loses their goddamn minds.
That is probably one of the best parts of the trials, is just watching the character animations as they start to sweat bullets, and when they like really start losing their shit. It's fun. It's very fun. And yes.
It's worth talking about, like, the aesthetics of this, mm-hmm. especially in the Game Boy Advance or the Game Boy Advance and DS versions. I don't like the updated remaster graphics. I don't think they're very good. Mm-hmm. But in the originals, like, they're very beautiful, big, expressive sprites that have awesome mm-hmm. little poses to them. And like getting the actual culprit into the part where they, rip their hair out or go into their like, oh gosh, I'm, like before they lose it, admit it. It's almost like watching a punch out, boss, like spiral and yes. fall over. It's like, it is that satisfying.
It is, because it's such a dramatic shift in what they look like from when they first came in self-assured and confident and cool and collected. And mm-hmm. so when you see them finally lose it, it's really fun, because it is very dramatic. It's, yeah. it's, it's all done anime style, manga style, artwork. And as such, it's very expressive to begin with, but just the body language that's conveyed and everything is just great.
Yeah. And the music in general is just chef kiss emoji, right? Mm-hmm. But like, especially the ways that it ratchets up tension as you get closer, like as you move in for the kill on a culprit, mm-hmm. is really good. And subtle, actually, the way that it is done, that it evolves kind of the themes and motifs. It's great.
It does. And it also speeds up a little bit when it gets more tense. And mm-hmm. so, it'll just get a little bit faster and a little bit faster, and it gets a little bit more anxious sounding. And you're like, oh, we're almost there, guys. We're almost there. And like, you're just riding it. So definitely, mm-hmm. Even if you are a person who tends to play, like if you're playing this on a handheld device and you tend to play that without sound because of one or another reason, I strongly recommend having an earbud in and listening to the music for this one, for sure.
Yeah.
So, because it definitely adds to the overall aesthetic, but also to your experience of the game, because mm-hmm. that's what makes it more exciting, is to have the musical cues, ramping your emotions up too as you try to puzzle through everything and you don't know where you're going either. Yeah. you're trying to figure it out and you're like, I don't know,
It really does draw you in, you think that it's impossible, but you find the one thing, and then, oh shit, the exhilaration, A, of, feeling pretty smart for noticing this thing, and B, of watching, it's like, yes, I scored a hit. It's like it's almost like a tennis match or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
for sure. So this game was really well received when it came out. In 2010, Capcom called the series one of their strongest intellectual properties, even. Mm-hmm. So, it's sound design and animation, as we've already mentioned, are both repeatedly praised across the board because they are just top notch.
Yeah.
The only complaints that really you see out there by and large are just that it's very linear, that you sometimes have to do the trial and error, if you don't know, what to do next, okay, we'll just try something else. And then, also, sometimes the testimony statements need to be pressed in a particular order at times in order to get all of the information to trigger. Like, the flags are dependent on the order in which you do things during the trial in certain parts.
That is very much a problem in 2, yes. in 2, 3, and in Case 5, which was actually developed after the first trilogy was done, to introduce mm-hmm. a character who would be important in Apollo Justice after they moved beyond the first trilogy, that like that pressing things in particular orders, I press a later statement so I can go back and press an early one, that sucks. Mm-hmm. Forcing you to almost do like a backtrack for no reason at all, doesn't hang together. It's not good.
Yeah. Well, one thing I will say too is that when you make mistakes, it's worth making mistakes sometimes, because the dialogue exchanges that happen with the judge or with Edgeworth or whatever are just so funny, where they're just like, you don't know what you're doing, and that has to do with what you just the way that it all plays out is just so good that it's worth messing up sometimes too. I will say that too.
I want to ask you just about like one particular like Pavlovian association. When you go to submit a piece of when you go to present a piece of evidence during a trial, do you like hold your breath, or not hold your breath, but you know what I mean, and wait to see if the music's going to cut away, if the music drops? Because if you present the right thing, the music drops. If you present the wrong thing, it continues, and you know you're about to get called a dumbass.
Yeah. I can't say that I was just as, you know, specifically worried about that so much as like overall. I get into it when, you know, you're getting close to the end and you're very, very close to getting it wrapped up and you're just waiting for the ball to drop, the other shoe to drop, you know, and for the actual confession and everything to happen. Like that's, I get really into it at that point, but I'm not necessarily going beat by beat like, oh yeah, I know, I just got that one. It's more like the overarching thing that I'm looking for. You know, because that music is, like I said, speeding up a little bit, and you know, it's getting a little bit more tense. I'm just waiting for the resolution.
Yeah.
And the only other thing that I would say about, there's a couple of other things I think we should kind of talk about before we go into the case by case run through.
Yes.
First off, this game series is five mainline games, five spinoffs, and a bunch of remasters. There was a live action film, which I watched, that was released in 2012. And there's an anime series, manga, drama CDs, stage plays, musicals, all different kinds of stuff. So, you know, quite a few different tangentially released products and things like that. I do not know how much the manga or the anime deviates from the original games. I know that there is some degree of deviation. There always is.
Yeah.
The live action film is very fun.
I was going to ask about that.
It's very fun. It's directed by Takashi Miike, and it's kind of like futuristic, where you have like these hologram displays of your evidence, and Phoenix Wright and Edgeworth will throw, they'll go kurai, and they'll throw the evidence hologram at the other person like they're doing a Hadouken. It's the funniest thing ever. And just seeing some of this in live action, because they do the really strong reactions just like they do in the game.
Oh, that's great.
But it's live action, and because it's live action, it is that much hokier and funny, because it is just, you're seeing people live action, you know, like there's one case, the very first case, and this is not really a spoiler, they rip the culprit rips off their toupee and throws it, and like that happens. That was like, I was just waiting for that in the live action. I was just like, okay, yes it happened, you know. And just looking forward to seeing the live action renditions of all of these characters.
Takashi Miike, I think most people here in America know him as a horror and action director. That's what I knew him for. But like, he's really prolific, and over in Japan, he does a bunch of, he basically alternates between comedies and then horribly gory horror movies, and you know, action movies, things like that. So like, it may seem like a strange fit, but it makes sense, especially when you describe it. I really need to sit down and watch that, because you make it sound like a good time. Also, like the idea that they have these holograms or whatever, something I think gets a little bit lost when people play this nowadays, is that back when they put this out in 2001, the idea, this technically is supposed to take place in like 2016. So it was casting into the far future for some of the elements where some of the technology would work. But also, you have people with flip phones and candy bar phones and stuff like that.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So it's fun that they lean into the futuristic element of it a little bit for the movie.
Oh yeah. It's kind of like this weird dystopia thing that isn't really addressed, except like you see this horrible dystopia in like the first few minutes of the movie, and then it just like cuts to the courtroom scenes where it's like, you know, this old school, old fashioned looking courtroom, but then this big hologram thing comes down from the ceiling and they throw evidence holograms at each other, and I don't know, it's something. It's worth a watch, I will say that. It's worth a watch regardless of whether or not you know anything about Phoenix Wright. It's not necessary in order to enjoy this wacky movie.
And it's based loosely on some of the cases from the first game, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, correct. So one other thing that I did want to mention too, we would be remiss if we did not talk about it, is the localization.
Yes.
Localization was outsourced to Bone Global. And basically they had to, in order to get the humor to work for this game, they had to lean heavily on the localization and less on the translation, if that makes sense, because mm-hmm. translation is directly, you know, porting literal words over, whereas localizing is where you are making it make sense for the audience that you are trying to reach. So, say for example, Phoenix Wright's name is Ryuichi Naruhodo in Japan, which mm-hmm. it's like Ryuichi is like Ryu is dragon, and like the kanji for his name is dragon, mm-hmm. and then Naruhodo is I understand, or you know, something like that. And so how they translated that name to make it make sense is instead of dragon, because that's not a person's name in English, Phoenix, that's a name in English, so okay, that works. Yeah. And then Wright, which they use as a pun for being correct versus W-R-I-G-H-T, you know, which is how it's spelled. Mm-hmm. So they make it a pun that way.
Yeah.
So, and then Edgeworth, his last name is Mitsurugi, which is sword. Like it's got the kanji for sword in there. Mm-hmm. So that's where they get the Edgeworth. And then also Worthy, you know, like that's one of the nicknames for him. That's also partially because of his cravat and his tea drinking and his whatever, you know, and just his general capability. I mean, yes, all of those things. So they tried to make it fit, and they went through a lot of painstaking, you know, iterations on a thing. Like Phoenix had maybe 20 different names that they were debating before they finally settled on one for him, for example. So they really worked hard to try to make it punny in English the same way that it is, or at least similar spirited to the way that it is in Japan.
It fits really well because the arc of every single case is it looks like he's dead in the water, but then, you know, from the ashes of his case, he rises and, you know, all that, like just the idea of being gone and then coming back unexpectedly, you know, encapsulated in the idea of the Phoenix is incredibly clever on the part of the localizers.
Mm-hmm. And also the location, at least in the first game, was also changed from Japan to the U.S. because the very first case involves time zones. Mm-hmm. And so they couldn't have the math on that be like wackadoodle, you know, for people in America to be like, I don't know. Like at that, back then at that time when it was first released in the U.S., people did not have, you know, the world clocks on their phones. You know, this is flip phone era. So, you know, people didn't have that kind of thing on there mostly. So, but of course they can't change the justice system. So like it doesn't translate over. It's kind of, you know, altered. Like they couldn't change the way that the courtroom stuff worked without changing the entirety of all the mechanics in the game. And that would have just transmogrified it into something else and lost everything at that point. So
right, the idea of adding a jury into this, I mean, that's a plot beat in Apollo Justice, but like the idea of adding a jury would change everything away from, you know, as opposed to the one judge who is literally every part of the process. Or, you know, and in Japan, like the judge and the prosecutor are on the same side, and it's the defense against it. It's real. It's messed up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That location shifting ends up causing, you know, some fun weirdness. There's a famous comic, you know, Eat Your Hamburgers, Apollo. You know, as they it's like looking out over Mount Fuji and a bunch of pagodas saying, ah, yes, Los Angeles, the greatest city in America. they eventually stop trying to hide it. I would say it was a good time to stop trying to hide it when they had Japanese mystics be some of the main characters in the series.
Yes. So basically from the very beginning of the series. But anyway, the time 20 years ago was a very different, looking America than it is today. So, you know.
But, oh, man. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that pretty much covers all the generalities that we've got overall for at least this first game in that kind of the overarching way that the series works. So I suppose at this point, this would be our spoiler wall. So if you want to play the game that's 20 years old and you haven't done it yet, here's the time to push pause and come back later.
I'll put in some music. So let's get started with case number one, the first turnabout, which is really just a tutorial.
It is definitely tutorial. You can tell because you have, I don't know who this guy is for your prosecutor. It's Winston Payne. I mean, he's just like a dude, you know, a middle-aged guy who's not Edgeworth. So, you know, he's not on the front image. So he's obviously like temporary. So.
Winston Payne, he is almost always the first person that you go up against. He becomes a running joke because he views Phoenix as this huge rival to him, but Phoenix has no idea who he is. And he also gets more pathetic as the series goes on up until, the sixth one, Spirit. Oh man, what is it? The sixth one for 3DS, where he ends up being the main prosecutor that you go against. He moved to a foreign land where he could reinvent himself as this, you know, undefeatable prosecutor, and he ends up becoming your worst nightmare.
That's pretty good. I have to say, when I started playing the second game and I saw him back for the tutorial again, I'm like, oh, here we go.
Time to humiliate this man.
Well, I have to say that one thing that the series does really well is whenever a character pops back up again, you're like excited about it. Even if you don't like the character, you're kind of excited about it anyway, because you're like familiar with them, and you're just like, it's kind of like coming back home, and here we go again. I know this one.
But we're introduced to a lot of the main characters here. So we have on the defense side, we've got Phoenix, Phoenix Wright, and then we have Mia, who is his mentor, Mia Fey. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mia Fey is the reason why I opened up the game. I started playing it on iOS, and I turned it off again because I'm like, she's got her boobies hanging out and she's just wearing like a bra underneath that jacket. Boy, I can't with the booby lady right now.
I really wish they didn't make her as booby as she is. Additionally, you know, we're past the spoiler wall because she comes back in spirit channeling form. I want to wring the neck of whoever decided whoever channels Mia ends up growing bigger boobs too.
Yes, that's a lot. I get the kind of idea of them beginning to look a bit like the, you know, person that they are channeling. I think that's something actually in spiritism, historically speaking, because I'm a nerd about that kind of thing. But like, they don't magically grow bigger boobs. And like, especially when they do it to like a prepubescent little girl channeler.
God damn it. No,
that was a big no.
Yeah.
That's it. Game two. We'll talk about that and get mad about that later.
But in
the meantime, yeah. But in the meantime, we can just say I hate it and put a pin in that for next time. Yeah. But yeah, that is the reason I turned it off. I'm like, I can't with this right now. I will come back to this some other time.
Yeah.
And I did later. But you've got Phoenix Wright, you've got Mia Fey, you've got Larry Butts, who is your defendant, who is also a pal of yours.
Yeah, childhood friend. You know, your fuck up friend.
Yeah, your fuck up friend, and he's a running character that comes back. So and you also, of course, have Winston Payne for prosecutor. You're introduced to the judge, who, I'm sorry, the judge is awesome. I love the judge.
The judge is great.
Yeah, he's got a lot of great personality quirks, and just, you know, he has a lot of really fun lines throughout the game. So I very greatly enjoy the judge.
Yeah.
So, but your friend Larry has been accused of killing his ex-girlfriend Cindy Stone, and you are supposed to bail him out.
Yeah, it's like, hey, you just got your attorney's badge. Can you help me? And this has resonance because it mirrors something that happened earlier in both of their lives. But yeah, you know, Larry didn't do it. And they've got this witness by the name of Frank Sawit. a lot of the names are really on the nose, which like lends to the kids' comic feeling of this, which is also strange because every single case involves kind of a horrible murder.
Well, the kids' comic kind of vibe that goes along with these puns is part of what makes it lighthearted in a way, even though it is all these terrible murders, but also it kind of sets you up for, you know, getting really excited about those super over the top expressions and changes that go on with the animation in the characters themselves as well, for me at least, because it kind of feels kind of like a Dick Tracy kind of thing, you know, where all the names of the characters are really on the nose and puns with how they look or something about them. And like the whole world is just super exaggerated and silly, but that's you know, like a detective and he's fighting mobsters and stuff. So it's the same kind of thing. That would be an equivalent for America, I would say.
Yeah.
Something like that.
I like how outsized it is.
Yeah, for sure. So the problem with Larry, the big problem with Larry, is that he likes to stick his foot all the way into his mouth so far that it comes out of his butt.
which is impressive.
It is. So he manages to get himself dug deeper and deeper into a hole, even though he is innocent. And so that is why, you know, this becomes a little bit tricky and all of that. But
yeah.
Frank saw it, said that, you know, he's a newspaper salesman, and he says that he saw it, and he saw Larry coming out of the Cindy's apartment and all of that right around the time that the murder happened and all this mess. And so that's what we've got going there.
Yeah. The murder weapon was a statue of the Thinker, Rodin's Thinker. And that ends up being the kind of the key to the case. It's real simple. You know, one day there's no investigation here. Very simple case where the actual time of the murder becomes salient because the saw it. He doesn't know that the Thinker statue is a clock.
And Cindy, the victim, had just gotten back from being overseas in Paris. And so she comes back home and then ends up breaking up with Larry. and then, you know, that's the main kind of premise. That's why Larry's running off from the apartment in such a hurry.
You know, at that point, because it serves as motive, right?
Yes. And so in any case, like, that she just comes back home. And what actually happened is that Frank saw it. Is a common burglar who was gonna just like rob the place and was casing the place out. And when he saw Larry leave, decided that, oh, he needed to go and rob the place now before somebody else got there, not knowing that Cindy had come back. And so Cindy was in the apartment at the time. So he happens to walk in on her and you know, ends up clocking her over the head because he panicked. And yes, I did that on purpose.
Thank you. I like it.
It's suitable for this particular podcast about this particular game.
Yeah. So he kills her in a panic because he doesn't want to witness and then runs away thinking, okay, I can pin it on this schmuck.
Indeed. But what he didn't know is that when he was talking about, oh, I heard the clock sound or whatever, that he didn't know that the thinker that he had smacked Cindy with actually was a clock, and mm-hmm. that clock she had taken with her to Paris. And so the time zone thing that we mentioned earlier mm-hmm. Happens in this very first case where the clock sounded the hour, but the hour was off because she had just come back from a trip out of state. So, mm-hmm.
And this is a really good first case because it's kind of teaching you that not every piece of evidence is what it seems. Right. Mm-hmm. And that the ways that they differ from your expectation, you know, will almost always be the actual key to the case. So not only is this a clock, not only is this statue not a statue, it's a clock, but that clock, you know, tells its own story because of the way that it's set. Right. And mm-hmm. the kind of asymmetry in the information where the suspect doesn't know what you know is kind of how you can get trip them into lies. Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this is a very good tutorial for the more interesting part of the video game for sure, because there is, as you mentioned, no investigation whatsoever in this one. So that ends up working really well. It kind of gets you into the feel of it and, you know, hold your hands a little bit before they start introducing other elements. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. And the thinker statue is not going to go away. It's going to come back.
Yeah. In case two, Turnabout Sisters. So, right when I had first played this on the iOS and I got mad at the game and I talked about it on the level,
right.
You had told me, oh, don't, and maybe it wasn't you, maybe it was some of the listeners, somebody or multiple somebodies said, oh, don't worry, she goes away real quick. Well, yeah, she's the victim. Like, your mentor, Mia Fey, is the victim in mm-hmm. the second case. Your mentor has been murdered in your office. So now you have to figure out what's going on with that. And the defendant in this case is Mia Fey, who is a super important character, mm-hmm. Recurring character that shows up. And Mia Fey is Mia's younger sister.
Yes. The Fey family, they are from the village of Corain, and they're real big deals in the world of being spirit mediums. Mia, you know, left the tradition and went to become a lawyer, but Mia is training in spirit channeling. And so she's kind of come here for a visit and walks in on her murdered sister and ends up being right in the position to be framed for her sister's murder.
Mm-hmm. And the murder weapon is, surprise, the thinker statue, which has come back again. Here it is again. We see it show right back up again.
Yes.
So your prosecutor this time is Miles Edgeworth, who is somebody that also Phoenix knows from his childhood as well, although you don't know that off the bat, I do not believe. I think that kind of comes up a little bit later, isn't it?
You don't know that it's from childhood. You know that they knew each other, and Phoenix is like, yeah, that guy's a dick, but I don't know why. He's changed, you know, since I knew him. Mm-hmm. And Edgeworth, you know, everybody talks about him with bated breath, not just because bated breath. Everybody talks about him sotto voce, you know, afraid, you know, just they're afraid of him, because not only because he hasn't lost a case, but because there are rumors abounding that he forges evidence, that he does whatever it takes to win. And, you know, we're past the spoiler wall. That's not the case. It is the system that it is his mentor and kind of everybody around him that is corrupt, but he's actually a straight shooter. He's just a dick about it.
Yeah. He's a dick, especially right at the beginning, because he's so full of himself because he hasn't lost a case and because he feels he has something to prove. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, kind of what goes on there with that. Yeah. So, and all of that unravels, of course, as we go along. But insofar as this case is concerned, Maya was found at the scene of the crime unconscious, and Mia was found dead. And on a piece of paper in blood was written Maya on a piece of paper, you know, on that little sheet of paper. So what this did is basically cause everybody who saw it to go, oh, well, that must have been, you know, with the last of her strength, she wrote Maya's name.
Yeah.
You know, that this is the name of my killer is Maya.
Mm-hmm. So I need everybody to know. But it turns out to be forged, right?
Mm-hmm. It's forged. So your witnesses in this case are, of course, the detective, which we meet, Dick Gumshoe is a great character. He's a recurring character. He is your detective guy for almost every case. There's only the fifth case in this game has a different detective person. Mm-hmm. But he testifies all the time because he's the detective leading the investigation. Mm-hmm. Then you've got April May. She's your primary witness, who is a lady with big jiggly boobies and who is very flirty.
This game gets off on the horniest foot.
It does. And not only that, but like it kind of runs for the first three cases.
Yeah, because then you get windy. Yeah.
Well, you not Wendy Oldbag. You get Salmonella, the gross tongue wagger.
You're right, the otaku dude. Yeah,
yeah, that guy. That was terrible. That was the one that, like, okay, I could deal with April May. I complained a little bit about Mia Fey, but then when I got to Salmonella, I almost threw my switch at that point. I was like, that is gross. Like, that is just gross, man.
Yeah. But the way he curves over Maya, it's too.
Too much.
I repressed Sal. We'll get to him. But
yes,
you know,
we will.
Yeah.
In the meantime,
April May. She's like, she has pink hair, pink shirt. You know, big breasts on display.
Yeah, flirty. Yeah. Sticks her tongue out and winks at you and looks all cutesy. And that's kind of her deal, mm-hmm. you know. And so that's your main witness. She says that she was in the hotel across from the law office and saw the whole thing happen through her window. And she's got an alibi because she happened to have some coffee delivered to her room by the bellboy of the hotel that she's staying at. So yeah. she was there. And she just happened to see it happen through the window.
Yes. So. Yeah. And it turns out that the times don't line up. And also there's evidence of the actual scheme that is laid around because April May is working with Red White.
Of Blue Corp.
Yep. and it's I think it's funny that they introduce Miles. It's like, yeah, this guy, he's haughty. He's real cocky. He's got a real high opinion of himself, but we don't want him to be the worst person in the room. So let's take somebody who commits every sin that Miles, that Edgeworth, superficially commits and give you this asshole who like will literally like hold up the gems, like his gem encrusted fingers. Cause he wears all this big jewelry.
He has all this big jewelry. He has a shiny, sparkly jaw, maw of teeth that he probably gets super whitened, like extra whitened. He's probably had lots of plastic surgery. Like, not that there's any evidence of that, but like that's just kind of the vibe you get. He's got this very bright loud suit on and that whole kind of deal. April May is actually Red's secretary. So what's shady is that like in April May's, like during the investigation, you happen to find a wiretap in April May's room. And because you are Phoenix Wright in this particular game, you take the wiretap as evidence, which don't tell anybody. don't do that thing, but that will not hold up in court if you take it. But anyway,
yeah. do not use this as your textbook, please.
Yes.
You will fuck your clients over. Please. Yeah. But he finds the wiretap, because these are blackmailers. Like basically the only reason that Red White is so successful is because he does corporate espionage.
Yes. Blue Corp, his corporation, is an information gathering corporation. Mm-hmm. One element that we did not mention is that there is another attorney, Grosberg, who is originally requested by Maya, the defendant, to be her attorney, but Grosberg is like never in his office. And when you finally flag him down, he says that he won't take the case.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is he is also being blackmailed by Red White and will not take the case because he can't, because of the blackmailing situation.
And you only learn that because of the painting, right? Like,
there is a painting that was in Grosberg's office that somehow migrates mysteriously over to Red White's office. And you go, oh, hey, I've seen that painting before, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was part of, it was kind of the telltale painting that kind of mm-hmm. revealed that this guy, this, you know, asshole had everybody under his thumb. But he was surveilling Mia. Do we know why he was
yes, wiretapping because her? Mia was investigating his blackmailing and had evidence of, you know, some of the names of some of the people that he had blackmailed, including a celebrity that had committed suicide recently or something. And so it was like incriminating evidence that she was gathering because she had been setting a case against him, like working on a case against him for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so that information actually was stuck inside the Thinker statue. She took the clockwork out and put the information, like hid the information inside this Thinker statue, because this case started with a phone conversation between Mia and Maya. Mm-hmm. And she was saying, look, I've got this statue. It's really important. I need you to hold on to it. You know, there's no, it's a clock, but there's no clockwork in it and all this other mess. And Maya's phone actually is part of the evidence that you end up taking, because there's a recording of, you know, that whole conversation.
Right.
So,
yeah. But the evidence inside the statue is one thing. Also, the eyewitness testimony that that April gives can't be accurate because she got her story and, you know, kind of like talked about it with Red. She mentions the fact that a lamp broke, but because of the way that the lamp was kind of set over in a corner, she would not have been able to see it through a window. So she, you know, in her testimony reveals something that she would have no way of knowing unless she was talking with somebody who was in the room.
I think what actually, wasn't it Red that saw the lamp and he was the one who had to testify? And that's why he was like, oh yeah, I put the wiretap in there. And that's when I saw the lamp and his timing was wrong. I think because when April May had the bellboy bring the drinks, there were two drinks.
Right. Yes.
And so they found out there was someone else staying there. And the bellboy saw a picture of Red White when you showed it to him. And he said, yeah, that's the guy that was staying in the hotel with her.
There we go.
And
okay.
And what happened was April said, well, Maya went to the left and then, I don't know if it was the left or the right, but Maya went one way and then Red said she went the other way. And then that's because he was in the room. And so it was,
I mean, something that happens, you're not always presenting evidence. They'll often show you like a, you know, either a photo from the scene where you point out the contradiction or a floor plan where you can say like, okay, so where was this person actually? And this is one of the first times they do that because, you know, he says, she went left, I went right. Or the murderer went right. No, you had it backwards because you were looking at it from the other, you know, because you were actually the person who killed it, is one of those like little, eureka moments that you get.
Yeah. And then not only that, but the lamp, that lamp that you mentioned is a part, but I think it was part of Red's testimony.
Gotcha.
Because Red said, oh, well, I saw that the lamp was broken. Well, you can't see from the window across the way that it was a lamp because of the cone of vision from that window is such that you wouldn't have seen it. You had to have been in there.
Yeah.
And then he claims that he saw it when he tapped, you know, he admitted to the wiretapping and then said that he saw the lamp there when he tapped the phone. Mm-hmm. However, on the back of that piece of paper that has Maya's name spelled out in blood, you find out that it's actually a receipt for that very lamp from the day before the murder.
Right.
So there's no way that he could have seen that lamp because the lamp didn't exist in there a week ago. It was only just the day before the murder when that lamp was placed.
Yeah.
And that's how you end up breaking the whole thing down. But see, this is part and parcel of like that whole, it's like one little tiny thing that you're hanging on to and you don't know how it fits to anything else yet. But like, as you keep going and you keep pulling at the thread, everything starts to unravel. And that's where you get this guy and his accomplice, April May.
So. Yeah. Who they set up an alibi by having her order some coffee from a bellboy who I think Miles adopts.
I don't know. I do know that the bellboy ends up taking over the hotel or something, and then like ends up like, you know, pimping the hotel out. Like, oh yeah, this is a place that murder and that intrigue happened. It's here, you know, and like using that to promote his hotel.
Yeah, but it's just funny because that same bellboy shows up in Edgeworth's office delivering tea. It? So I think I joked that he adopted it. I think Edgeworth is actually like ordering tea specifically from this hotel because it's very good.
Yes, I think, and now that you mentioned that, I think you're correct. I think he did end up having the bellboy drive his tea over to his office and deliver it personally.
God, what a dick.
Because, yeah, well, he also drives like a fancy sports car and like everything. Like he's very fancy boy. So, yeah, but that's how we wrapped up the second case. And that's where it starts getting super convoluted. And as these go on, they just get more and more convoluted. So, you know, we will endeavor, everybody, to get everything straight. But it's real hard to keep it straight.
It is.
You know, yeah. Even while you're playing the episode itself.
That's the game, is straightening it out, because everything is presented to you all tangled up. Yeah. But now that Maya is not in detention, she decides that she's going to be your sidekick now. Like she's going to be your assistant at the right everything agency is what it ultimately ends up being called.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
So then we move on to case three, Turnabout Samurai. So this one introduces the Steel Samurai, who is a TV character, you know, kind of like
a Sentai
kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of a Sentai kind of thing, fighting evil villains and stuff. And this is something that Maya really likes to watch on TV. Well, the victim in this case is Jack Hammer, who played, I believe he played the evil magistrate, didn't he?
Yes.
Okay. And the defendant is Will Powers, the guy who plays the Steel Samurai. But the Steel Samurai has a mask on. And so something that they keep on rolling with in this case that I just never understood is they kept on saying that Will Powers was this ugly, horrible looking man that needed to wear a mask. He needed to put the mask back on. And I'm like, he's just hirsute. What's the problem? Like, he just has hairy face. Like, he's got not sideburns. Ugly. Like, whatever, you know. So it was kind of funny that way.
He's grizzled, you know, he's got kind of a Wolverine style, style vibe to him. But, you know, he's a softie is what he is. You know,
he is a big softie, super, super nice guy. Yeah.
But yeah, you know, this is the most popular show in kids afternoon television and, you know, huge scandal. And Maya immediately wants to take the case because, you know, we have to rescue the Steel Samurai, right?
Mm-hmm. So this is where you get to meet Wendy Oldbag, who is the guard lady who's at the studio entrance. And so she doesn't want to let you in. She wants to be super contrary. She's kind of like the gossipy old lady trope. So you know, she's like, oh, I heard this and they say this and stuff like that. And she's also a really big fan of
specifically of Jack Hammer. You know, Jack Hammer is kind of a little bit past his prime. He used to be a much bigger, you know, kind of like leading man. And she thinks it is a huge indignity that he is here playing this, you know, here playing this villain, you know, playing second fiddle to Will Powers, who she thinks is, you know, just a piece of shit.
Inept.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so she has, she will get in your way every step of the way because she does not want Will Powers to be walking free.
Yeah, and I think what it is Jack Hammer used to play the Steel Samurai And at some point in the past, he ended up switching roles to being the evil magistrate. Everybody wears masks, so it doesn't matter.
Right.
And then Will Powers took over from there and became the new Steel Samurai. And, you know, Old Bag's just like, no, Jack Hammer is the best one and all of that. Yeah. So
there was definitely Jack Hammer fell. Oh, I just got that, actually. Jack Hammer.
Yeah.
It's been 15 years since I first played this, and I'm just now getting Jack Hammer. Fuck.
Wow.
No, just like the he part of his fall from grace was this old scandal, what appeared to be a murder that the studio covered up. That's part of what we're going to find out.
Yeah. So basically, when they were doing some training, they were doing like practicing one of the fight scenes or something. The training partner had accidentally been knocked into a spiky as hell metal fence that I don't know why they would have this kind of super goth thing around like a trailer at a studio, but they did, and he died.
Yeah. The way this guy got impaled on it, you would think it was rebar.
Yeah. Yeah. And that his name was Laura Croft. Yes. So yeah, Jack Hammer was after that felt really horrible about the entire thing. It was mm-hmm. covered up by the studio, but then he was kind of blackmailed into taking the role of the evil magistrate for like crap pay and all of that.
And it was the producer, right? Who we don't meet for a little while, but she's not she's not a good person, and she is wrapped up with the hilarious coterie of Yakuza toughs that she has with her.
Yeah.
I love these guys. They don't say anything. They just appear to be like, you are to be menaced now, and their animation is just like all cracking their knuckles. Uh-huh. It's so good.
Yeah, and it's definitely got that whole, because she's like smoking her long elegant pipe thing and wrapped up in a shawl and looks really like super fancy and like self-assured and that kind of a thing, because you know she's this important producer lady who has control over all of this stuff and can you know eat you for breakfast.
She is, you know, far bigger than you and has more control over the situation. This is the first like multi day case kind of thing. And kind of the thing that makes this you know not open and shut is the fact that everybody is walking around in these big costumes, right? Their identities are concealed. Also, you know, there was a storm that knocked over and like blocked one of the main roads in the studio. And you know the fact that, you know, oh, we have a photo, but we can't tell who is in that costume actually. And also they couldn't have gone from here to here at this time ends up being the confounding thing that you have to figure out in order to determine what actually happened here.
Yeah, because you've got security cameras, you've got Old Bag's testimony, you have Penny Nichols, who's like an assistant lady who was in one of the studios, and like, you know, they found the body in Studio One, but, you know, then Dee Vasquez, who is the producer, and Sal Minella, who is like the writer or whatever, like the gross man.
Yeah.
Director. Oh, yeah, he's a director. He's horrible, absolutely horrible character. They were together having a meeting in the trailer in Studio Two, and the way was blocked between the two studios because of like a downed tree from was it a tree or was it,
it was the mascot studio statue.
The mascot statue that fell over. And then you even have a little kid that is a big fan of the Steel Samurai who comes and sneaks into the studio to watch practice and happens to witness the murder.
Yeah.
And has a camera and, you know, like didn't actually open the lens, you know, couldn't open it up in time to take the picture of the thing. But anyway, so you've got all these different people seeing, you know, the Steel Samurai walking around. And he's got a limp when they see him walking by. And like there's some intrigue about the weapon that was supposedly used, because everybody assumes that it is the Steel Samurai spear, but that spear was broken during practice, like the day before or something like that, conveniently. So there were sleeping pills involved. Somebody found sleeping pills. Or you find sleeping pills.
All the food that's still out. I love this studio. We're just sort of like, all right, 1 o'clock.
We're just going to leave.
Union mandated steak break.
Yep. Yep. Stakes.
Oh yeah. Man. Yeah. Do we want to say what actually happened? Because sure. it was a botched revenge, right?
Mm-hmm. It was a botched revenge. Jack Hammer, who had been guilt ridden and, you know, stuck in this crappy role for 5 years, ends up wanting to kill the producer, Dee Vasquez. Mm-hmm. And goes to Studio 2 dressed up as the Steel Samurai to try and frame Will Powers, the guy who actually plays the Steel Samurai now.
Dick move.
Yeah, and drugged Powers, mm-hmm. So that he was asleep at the time and could, you know, would not wake up. Took the costume, went to Studio 2 and tried to kill the producer. Well, the producer, in self-defense, pushed Jack Hammer and ended up accidentally killing him on the fence. Like, that's two murders in a row that have happened with the same weapon. You know, like the two people killed with the Thinker statue, and then, yeah, you know, two people got shoved on this fence. Like, they're recycling this quite a bit, but it works. Yeah. And so, yeah, it was wholly unintentional. She didn't have a motive. She just was trying to defend herself from Jack Hammer. Yeah. And basically at that point, she had Salmonella and his van move the body from that studio over to Studio 1 to set it up to look like, you know, somebody had come and murdered him there.
Yeah. Everybody has it out for Wills.
Yep. Yeah. So it was very convoluted, and this is the first case where it really digs back into the past, into you know, something that happened a long time ago is the actual motive for what is going on right now. It's a very like Hindu kind of, you know, yeah, karma kind of thing happening, yeah, here, where like, you know, nothing exists in isolation. There's actually some strings you don't know about back there that are, mm-hmm, being pulled that caused this to happen.
Yeah. It's a preview of what we're going to get in cases 4 and 5, which is, yes, like, you know, we're going, how? It's a turducken of cases. Like, in order to solve this one, you have to solve this case that is just about to pass its statute of limitations. Case 4 and 5 are so fucking similar.
They are so similar. It's like, it's very obvious that they made case 5 just to show off what the hardware can do, because, yeah, that's exactly what they made that case for. Yeah. But I will note that in case 3 was really when I first started feeling that adventure gamey like frustration of where am I supposed to go now, like that it started happening there, because the first couple of cases are a lot easier to suss out,
especially with the little kid, like getting him, mm-hmm, to show up and doing the thing that you need to do to make him actually speak to you, like you're, mm-hmm, organizing a trade for, like, you know, special Steel Samurai merchandise that he couldn't get in order to get him to talk. Like, going, uh-huh, around the studio, it's a bummer. Yeah. And, you know, moving from place to place, like, you open up a menu and it shows you all the places you can go from where you're at. I really wish that there was just a way to, like, you know, pick a spot on the map. Yes.
Yes. Because what it is, it's like a whole maze of spots where it's like you go to the studio entrance, and from the studio entrance you can go to the, you know, Studio 1, or you can go to Studio 2, or you can go, mm-hmm, to the courtyard or whatever, and then you go to the courtyard, and then that's the only way that you can get to Jack Hammer's room or Will, mm-hmm, Power's room or whatever. And it's, you can't just skip from the studio entrance to the room of the guy you're trying to inspect. You have to go through this whole, you know, maze of hallways, let's say, where you have to make all these little extra clicks in the menu.
Yeah,
it's do they later on eventually speed that up and make that better, or is that always suffering?
It's pretty much always the same, unfortunately. You can tell what they want is, okay, you're going to, you know, they're like, this is your destination, this is where you need to go. You know, if there's somebody that we need to make sure that you speak to, we want to have them standing in the space right before you get to your destination, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a way for you to, you know, incidentally run into more people. I think that's dumb and bad, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, no, if they want you to encounter that, that should just go ahead and happen anyway on your way there. It shouldn't be a menu tax, you know?
Right.
So
agreed.
It's 20 years old though. I can't complain too much.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Let's talk about case four, which yes. I mean, I like case four a lot. I think that I was about to say the case that's 100 years long. No, I'm thinking of case five. Case four is actually
case five is yeah. Case four is at least riveting for a good portion of it, whereas case five, which we will get to, it just seems to drag ass quite a bit.
Yeah, and also case five introduces a bunch of new characters, whereas this is, you know, a real strong payoff. Because you are defending Miles, you're defending Edgeworth, who apparently killed this. What is it? It's another lawyer,
prosecutor, or yeah. defense attorney, actually, yes. Robert Hammond.
Yes, he's killing Robert Hammond, and like the opening cutscene, we see it. Sure looks like he shoots Robert Hammond on a boat.
Yep. It sure does, and he even says, "I killed him." And
yeah, okay. He wants you to throw the case. Like, yeah. Do not defend me.
Yep. And the prosecutor in this case is Manfred von Karma, who is Miles Edgeworth's mentor.
Yeah.
And if you thought that Edgeworth was insufferable, don't worry. Or Red White was insufferable, don't worry. Manfred von Karma combines the two.
Yep.
With their powers combined, you get Manfred von Karma, who's got all the bling. Uh-huh. He's very fancy dressed. He's got super cravat, slick backed hair, and the attitude on this man.
Oh. Yeah, everything with von Karma is a foregone conclusion, and the like control that he has over the judge and Gumshoe, he's very imposing, let's say. But he's
very imposing, and he is also has a perfect record of winning all of his cases. So he's obsessed, in fact, with that perfection, which, boy, does that really wear on me over time, especially when I get into the second game. But we'll talk about that some other time.
Yes. Yeah. No, the second game, the prosecutor is his daughter who carries on some of his, you know.
And makes it worse. Yep. It's so much worse. Yep. But anyway, we'll talk about this one for now. So you've got Gumshoe, of course.
Yes.
Your main witness, at least initially, is Lotta Hart, who Lotta Hart is basically, I think she's supposed to be like Osaka in the original.
Yeah.
But she's got like a country kind of accent, and she's got a big fro, and she lives in a van, and she's hanging out by the side of the lake where the murder has taken place in this park, because she's a photographer, and she's trying to take pictures of basically a Loch Ness monster that's in this lake. Gordy.
She pretends that she's not, though. She pretends that she's like a researcher from the college.
Yeah. She pretends that she's more important than she is, because she didn't want to be laughed at for trying to take pictures of this fake monster. So
yeah. Lotta recurs. I didn't expect her to be be recurrent like she is, but she pops back up in the second game as well. No, she pops back up in the next case. Sorry, I'm confused.
She does. She shows up in the second game too.
You know what? You're right. So. Yeah.
Yeah.
I played all of this way too close to each other. but yeah, Lotta Hart's kind of she's a fame seeker. And she's very eager to cooperate with the prosecution, because she thinks it's gonna make her famous.
Yeah, and she's not a bad character. Like, some of these characters are just like bad people, but like, she's not a bad character. She's just in it for a particular priority.
Yeah. We also have Larry Butts, who's a hot dog vendor now. Yep.
He comes back, and not only that, but he's got a steel samurai blow up character that ended up falling into the lake, and that's how he ended up having to go out into the lake to look for his steel samurai blow up thing that has deflated.
Yep.
In fact, I think, doesn't Lotta Heart get a picture of quote unquote Gordy, but it's actually like the Steel Samurai blow up.
Yeah. He was trying to inflate it from a tank and it exploded. Yeah. Well, that's what people thought Gordy, what people thought was Gordy was Larry Butts fucking around with this tank and the Steel Samurai blow up.
Uh-huh, because he was trying to sell samurai dogs because, you know, Steel Samurai is so big. So
yeah, you know what moves hot dogs? Copyright infringement.
Yeah. So, of course, that is very true with little kids. If it has, you know, like the name on it, shoot, that's all you need.
Kids, what was it? That real depressing experiment where kids would get given a choice between a banana and a rock with a SpongeBob sticker on it. When they're hungry, they would rather reach for the rock with a SpongeBob sticker on it.
Yeah, that's survival at its best.
Yep.
Anyway, we do also have another character as a witness, the boat guy, the guy who owns the boat dock thing, Yanni Yogi, who is apparently very forgetful, doesn't remember anything, a little bit off, and his parrot Polly, who is this egregious mixture between a macaw and a cockatoo. It looks like it's got the coloration of a macaw, but it's got a cockatoo frill.
So. Yeah, it just Polly shouldn't be. Polly shouldn't be.
Yes,
but they have to get this. They have to get the courtroom or detective cliche of the parrot being a witness and getting that bird on the stand. That bird gets on the stand. Did you expect the bird to get on the stand?
I did not necessarily. I figured it would play a part, but I was very, very happy when the upsetting parrot ended up on the stand. It made me very happy. And also how that worked in the movie was also very fun, too, the live action movie. So definitely recommend that as well.
Yeah. So this is not the last time that they will have you interview or cross-examine an animal. In the fifth game, it's a
whale
DLC.
Or a dolphin or something.
It's a killer whale. You have to cross examine an orca. Yeah, in the DLC for the fifth game.
Why not? It's this game. I mean, like this is one of those games where you're just like, okay, anything goes. It's fine.
I'm on for the ride. So. Yeah.
So this is the first game that has like an overlapping of cases where there was a case that happened a long time ago that is now impacting what is happening right now. It's the infamous DL6 incident, and the statute of limitations is up that day for that case. Mm-hmm. So the two things kind of intertwine. Okay, so the main thing at the very, very beginning when you're first trying to unravel all the threads is that you have Edgeworth, you have Robert Hammond on the boat in the lake, and there are a couple of gunshots, and Lotta Heart is on the shore, and she's got a camera set up with a microphone that will automatically take a picture when it hears a loud noise, trying to catch a picture of this big, you know, sea monster.
Yes.
So that happens, and she gets a photo of these two people out on the lake, and you know, that's what you start with. And as you go, Larry Butts pops up and says, wait, because like basically Edgeworth was going to be found guilty. In fact, I think he did get found guilty.
The gavel went down.
Yeah, and he was found guilty, but then right then Larry Butts shows up and says, wait a minute, I was there that night and I remember I heard something, and then he testifies. And it turns out that he actually has some solid testimony in there, even though a lot of what he says is kind of BS and fiddly, like, because Larry. Oh,
puffery, you know.
Yeah. But basically there was a conflict between the number of shots being heard and at what time and things like that. Like Larry was listening to some headphones and the DJ had said on the radio what time it was right when a pistol sounded.
It was Christmas Eve, right?
Yes. Yeah. And that's what trips up the first contradiction in the evidence where you're trying to unravel what's going on. Mm-hmm. So then later on, you end up finding out that it's all related to the DL6 incident. This Yanni Yogi guy, you don't even know who he is. He doesn't have any fingerprints. They were burned off at some point. Yeah. And he doesn't remember his own name and things like that. But the Robert Hammond guy and Edgeworth and Von Karma all have something to do with this DL6 incident from a long time ago.
Yeah, they're linked by Edgeworth's dad, who was a defense attorney, right?
Yes, he was a defense attorney and had a trial against Von Karma. And that was the DL6 incident. And during that trial, Edgeworth's father managed to have like a strike against Von Karma. Like he had his first blemish on his record. He still won the case. Von Karma still won the case, but like he got a penalty in court and that pissed him off.
Yeah. My perfect record has a blemish. How dare you?
Yes. Yanni Yogi also is a part of this because he used to serve as a bailiff and he was the bailiff at the time. Now, because it's this game and everything kooky has to happen, the bailiff Yanni Yogi, Edgeworth and Edgeworth's father were all in the elevator when an earthquake happened and knocked off the power. And when the power went off, it was off for hours and getting all, you know, claustrophobic and stuff. Yanni and Edgeworth's dad got into an argument and somehow Yanni Yogi's gun came out of its holster where it was strapped and ended up on the floor. Edgeworth Miles took the gun and threw it at the two of them, just trying to get them to, he didn't know what it was. He just picked something up and then threw it at them to just get them to stop fighting. The gun went off and there was a scream. And then everybody passed out from lack of oxygen, finally. Yeah. So, and then everybody was found in the elevator. Edgeworth's dad had been shot. And Yanni Yogi was tried for the murder. So that's what happened with that. And Robert Hammond ended up becoming the defense attorney for Yanni Yogi during that trial and told him to plead, you know, like mental instability, you know, not insanity, but like, you know, some other kind of mental breakdown kind of thing. Yeah. And temporary insanity effectively. And he ended up getting off without being convicted for the crime. However, his fiance, Polly, ended up committing suicide and he lost his job and he lost his social standing and everything after all of this happened. So he kind of ended up turning into a recluse and named his parrot Polly and was, you know, very depressed and lived basically as this boat caretaker guy at a anonymously for the last 15 years. And then during this year, he managed to get a letter from who knows where with a gun and a plan, a murder plan, a revenge plan.
You can get back at the people who ruined your life, basically. You know, this Edgeworth character who ended up getting you framed for a murder, you know, because he didn't do it. Right. There was an element, too, for Yogi where he was playing up his eccentricity, let's say, because of the statute of limitations. Like when you finally break through his shell and get him to testify, like he says, I had to wait for the statute of limitations to get up. Before I could actually start acting normal and move on with my life because I didn't want to raise suspicion, you know, partly because Manfred von Karma, who is a kind of a puppet master behind this, has used the DL6 incident to keep people under their thumb, under his thumb. Right. So like Edgeworth, you know, has repressed memories of what happened. Like he knows that his dad was, you know, killed during this. And it was so traumatic that like he still to this day is like claustrophobic and has bad reactions to like earthquakes and things like that.
And he also had nightmares for a number of years where he had heard the scream and, you know, all of this stuff. And he thought he killed his father.
So he was convinced, you know, like even if I'm not guilty in this instance, I need to go away for this. And, you know, Von Karma, who we're going to find out is the person who actually committed the murder, you know, almost by like, you know, tragic just happenstance, right? You know, use that to kind of like leverage Edgeworth and keep him under control. He never disabused Edgeworth of the notion that he was guilty of this.
And Edgeworth, even at one point in the game, says that he became a prosecutor just to like punish himself for what he did, you know, because he thinks that he killed his father and I don't know all this other stuff. So what actually ended up happening to continue that story and how Von Karma comes into play? Von Karma was floating around outside the elevator at the time that this argument happened. And so he goes over to the elevator, curious about all these yelling sounds coming from the elevator, right about the time when the gun sounds that Edgeworth had thrown sounds off, and the bullet goes through the door and incredibly ends up in Von Karma's shoulder. He gets shot in the shoulder just standing outside this thing after he got this, you know, like this kind of penalty situation. He's having a bad day, okay? So everybody passes out, and then when the elevator gets opened, you know, Von Karma's there, the power comes back on, the elevator opens, and Von Karma sees everybody's passed out, there's a gun there, there's this guy there, you know, like the bailiff guy, and then that hated man who put a stain on his reputation. So he shot Edgeworth's dad. Mm-hmm. And then, like, let Yanni Yogi take the rap for it. And he took a vacay so he could go heal. Yeah. And he still has the bullet in his shoulder. So you've got a metal detector, and that's how you find out, you prove, you know, there was a second bullet. Because the bullet, the gun had been fired twice. They only ever found the one bullet. The reason why is because the other bullet is in Von Karma's shoulder.
Yeah. So, you know, just he had this big vacation. Like, he's not the kind of person who would take a vacation. He obviously, he obviously went to heal. You know, he couldn't have gone to a doctor because it would have been reported. He probably didn't take it out himself. So, you know, if you're not guilty, sir, let us run this metal detector over you. And that ends up being the thing that undoes him.
Mm-hmm. So that was the very complex, but because of your already emotional involvement with many of the characters that play into this, being Edgeworth and Larry and Phoenix and all of this other stuff, you know, and like Phoenix is so dead set on trying to help Edgeworth. And like it comes up in this chapter why Phoenix is so dead set on trying to help Edgeworth. And the reason is because when they were little kids, Edgeworth had some money stolen from him. And for some reason, this is like this horrible traumatic thing they did. They had a class trial in this like grade school, like second grade class. Uh-huh. And everybody said that Phoenix did it because he was there or whatever. And then like Larry had stood up for him and said, hey, he said he didn't do it, so he didn't do it. And Edgeworth said, you don't have any evidence. That's not true. And, you know, he stood up for Phoenix, and that whole situation is why Phoenix decided he wanted to become a defense attorney and why he feels like he wants to help. Well, that's also why he wanted to help Larry, who's such a lame duck.
Larry
did him a solid once upon a time, and so like he still wants to help him, and then that's also why he wants to help Edgeworth, and so that's why he fights even when Edgeworth tells him to stop.
Well, you know, they knew each other as kids, they were friends, and after the DL6 incident, obviously a traumatized Edgeworth not only moved away, but his entire personality changed because he went under the thumb of Von Karma. Right. And so he knew like, hey, there's a good person in there. Let's just try to get him out of here. You know, it was faith and friends. Right. And that ends up being like a good thing. It's a joke about, you know, media of a certain kind. You know, and I'm not just talking about anime, but like media that is kind of aimed at, you know, kids or younger people or whatever, that like, isn't friendship good? Like, this does end up being kind of a heartwarming story about like loyalty and believing in people who you care about. Right. Yeah,
it does. And this is like where the game originally ended. Yes. And that's where it should have ended. But instead, on the later versions of the game after the DS, they have Case 5, Rise from the Ashes, basically because they wanted to use the DS's nifty, neat hardware functions of having a mic and a touch screen. And they did it solely so they could introduce some new mechanics where you can turn evidence around to look at it from all different angles, and you can use a fingerprinting dust to apply it and then blow into the mic to blow the excess dust away.
Spray and apparently you
Yeah, and apparently you could also shout objection into the mic for the trials, but it didn't always work. Nope. So you had to do it multiple times to scream objection. So mm-hmm. I just imagine these little kids go, objection!
Like, it's funny. These little kids, or Cole when he's, when he's 18. Objection! Objection!
Yeah.
He's a little bitch, objection. Yeah.
So
I love that. Just like we absolutely need to be able to turn the evidence around. That amazing trick that was done in 1996 in the original Resident Evil.
Right. Like it's, I know. And I'm just like, I don't know why this was such a big deal, but whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I alluded to this before. So you've got Phoenix, right? And you have Edgeworth as your prosecution. Maya's gone away.
Yes.
And so you get a new psychic for this, but pretty much everybody is gone. Like there's, you know, it's new characters who are like more outsized, and it's really hard to care about a Jake Marshall or an Angel Starr to me, and heaven forfend a Mike Meekins.
I liked Mike Meekins. Oh, yeah? Meekins was about the only character I liked out of these weirdos that you show up with. So in this case, you have basically Maya has gone back to Corain to go train. And so she's left to go back and do her spirit medium thing because, you know, she had tried in the prior cases to kind of summon Mia up and she couldn't like do it herself. It had to always be like under extreme duress or because Mia was kind of pushing and possesses her or something. Yeah. It's not like something that she can control. So she feels like she needs to go and basically work on herself, you know, mm-hmm. work on her ability so she can, you know, be more useful. So that's what she does.
Yeah.
And you are introduced to the Sky sisters, mm-hmm. Emma Sky, who is the one that takes over as your assistant, and then Lana Sky, who is your defendant. Yes. She is the chief prosecutor, and she has been found guilty, or no, she's being tried for the murder of Bruce Goodman, who is a detective.
Yes.
And so the prosecutor is, of course, Edgeworth again. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is that all of this stuff happened where, like, wasn't the body in Edgeworth's car, like in his trunk?
Yeah.
Or something?
At one point. So it appeared that Lana committed the murder in the trunk of Edgeworth's car.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Lana does not want you to defend her. So again, an element from case 4 that comes back is the defendant who does not want to cooperate with you, ultimately because she's under the thumb of a very powerful person within the system. Right.
She's another one, like some of the other recycled elements is the whole blackmail thing. Like she's under this other person's thumb because of a blackmail incident, which is exactly the kind of thing that happened mm-hmm. in the last case, or like in the Turnabout Samurai case. It was that same blackmail situation. So that happens rather frequently. And mm-hmm. as a matter of fact, that also happened in the Turnabout Sisters one with Red White. I mean, like all of the blackmail stuff mm-hmm. comes up kind of frequently.
But the big repeat is that you also have to solve this old cold case in order to, you know, prove a motive and explain why certain evidence that was used in the most recent case is noteworthy. You know, why you should question it. Right. And it ends up just being mm-hmm. like real sprawly. This also so many parts to this. This is what, a 3-day trial, and it's only 3 days because it's like that's the maximum in this system, you know, like in this court system. But there's, you know, multi-part investigations. There's multi-part days of trials, and like there's a whole mini trial in the middle of this as you relitigate the SL9 incident.
Oh, I know, and like just trying to like to go through synopses of these cases. Like the first one, it's like, okay, there's a paragraph. This one is just like I keep scrolling and scrolling. I need to see, like, actually I need to copy and paste it into Word and see how many pages printed it would be. I would not be surprised if it was like 20 pages worth of summary. Okay, like it's very long. It's like the case that will never ever end.
I did a print source on it. It's 25 without the summary of the SL9 incident. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and so the SL9 incident is the incident that happened in the past that is influencing what is happening in this case. And it comes up for many different reasons, but the murder weapon.
Oh, you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay.
But the murder weapon was actually a serial killer's switchblade. So yes. That's the first bit. But as you keep working to uncover information about, you know, what's going on, you find out that Bruce Goodman, Lana Skye, Damon Gant, who is the chief of police, Jake Marshall, Angel Starr, all mm-hmm. of these characters, like that, these are all witness names that I'm throwing out there, by the way. Jake Marshall and Angel Starr are also people who were detectives alongside Bruce Goodman for the SL9 incident, overseen by Lana Skye, who used to work with the police, mm-hmm. and Damon Gant, who was not at that time the chief of police. He ended up becoming chief of police later and then transferring Lana to the chief prosecutor spot.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. But the case that ended up, you know, making Gant's career and fucking over everybody else was the serial killer who finally turned himself in. But I think before he could go to trial, he ended up being killed in Gant's office and Gant and Lana's shared office, right?
Yes, that's exactly what happened. He was killed. And what happened was he had turned himself in due to feeling guilty, but then he was being interrogated by Neil Marshall, who is Jake's older brother, who I guess mm-hmm. was also a detective at the time.
Yeah.
And actually, he wasn't a detective. He was the prosecutor for the case.
Yeah.
And he was being interviewed. And then a storm, conveniently, nature does a lot of this, this stuff, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
A storm happens to knock the power out. And so Joe Dark was, you know, nervous by everything and ended up fleeing and going to Gant's office.
Yeah.
There, he found Emma Skye and thought that, you know, she'd seen him and, you know, he couldn't abide her living because, you know, she would tell, you know, where he went or whatever.
Yeah.
And so he tried to kill her. But right about then, Neil Marshall comes in and he ends up managing to subdue Joe Dark.
Yeah.
And then Emma ended up pushing somebody who she thought was supposed to be thought was Dark mm-hmm. into the wall, but it actually was Neil. And mm-hmm. then everybody passes out. I don't know why they all passed out, but like, I mean, the guys, because they were in a tussle, I don't know why Emma passed out, but some reason, trauma. Everybody passes out again, just narrative because, you know, yeah, narrative convenience reasons. And then Gant pops up on scene mm-hmm. and he thinks, hey, I can use this to my advantage. Everybody's passed out, much like a Von Karma. See how this is all kind of repeating?
Yeah. Yeah.
So didn't he just say, I'm just going to stab Neil? Like kill Neil, mm-hmm. like he framed Emma,
yeah,
for the stabbing, using that to blackmail Lana.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is he impales Neil Marshall,
yeah,
and
like
then,
picks him up and like puts him onto a statue's like sword or something.
Yeah, there was like a chief prosecutor of the year, chief, you know, award
like
or
something, like a halberd spear on it, yeah, that he got,
yeah. Yeah. And anyway, he sets it up to look like Emma had pushed him onto it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he leaves. And then Lana comes into the mm-hmm. office and sees her sister
yep.
and sees the very obvious looking scene where it looks like, oh, crap, my little sister is going to be prosecuted for, you know, killing this guy.
Yeah,
for
killing Marshall. Yeah.
Yeah. So then she tries to cover up the crime and put the murder on, you know, like put Neil's murder on Joe Dark.
Yes.
So she ends up changing the scene a little bit too.
Mm-hmm.
Dark ended up getting sentenced to death for his crimes and ended up dying.
Yes.
Meanwhile, Gant was made chief of police. And then, of course, he reappointed Lana to the chief prosecutor's office. So that way she could work in tandem with him to get whatever he wanted done in the courtroom.
Yeah. Just to have an airtight system of corruption where Gant could get his way no matter what.
Yeah, and so all of this is one giant power play. So how does this Bruce Goodman, who is the victim of this case in the current timeline, how does that affect anything? Well, Bruce Goodman was one of the people who was working on the SL9 case. Mm-hmm. The SL9 case kind of just ran cold, and it never really sat right with any of the investigators who were working on it, because it didn't add up 100%, and they knew that, and they felt that something, you know, there was something missing still from that case, and they wanted to reopen it. Bruce Goodman, on the day that the evidence was supposed to be transferred from the evidence locker, ended up coming across Gant in the evidence locker room and says, "I want to reopen the SL9 case." And then Gant, who doesn't want that reopened for pretty obvious reasons, ends up killing him, and then calling up Lana to help, have Lana help, you know, take the fall and, you know, get rid of all of this body and everything.
Yeah.
So, And of course, she cooperates because she's trying to protect her sister.
Yes. You know, sweet girl wants to be a scientific investigator because of her family. Does not want Emma to be, to be caught up in this. And, you know, this ends up, involving not just the old detectives, but we also have Meekins, who is a witness. Mm-hmm. He's like a rookie cop who is real uptight about the rules. Every time he talks, he's got to blow his whistle.
Yep.
Yeah.
He's a very silly character, but like it. I like him quite a bit just because he's like just well-intentioned and just happens to be in the middle of this shit. It's like, you poor little guy. Cause like at one point, didn't they even say you could have killed him and all of that? Like, well, they even try to pin it on him at one point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, they definitely tried to pin it on him because of what happened in the evidence room. Like he runs into and tussles with the person who he thinks is the killer, right? Because everything was set up, like part of the conspiracy with Lana was to make it appear, you know, ultimately made it appear that two people were killed, or the same person was killed in two locations at the exact same time, but in reality, the murder that supposedly happened in the evidence room that Meekins thought he did wasn't actually the case. He had gotten into an altercation with Jake Marshall, who was pretending to be Goodman. Mm-hmm. It's real convoluted.
And even trying to explain why was Jake Marshall dressed up as good, like there's so much going on. It's hard to get all the exact details about like the whys and wherefores, but that is precisely what this game is all about. So like, if you are curious, you should probably play it, because that's about the only way you're going to be able to hold it in your head for more than 5 minutes. Because the moment that you're done with it, you'll be like, I don't remember all of the details. You can remember broad strokes, but like
it's so especially egregious in Case 5 because they set up red herrings that are really only supposed to be like operative for about 5 minutes before you disprove them, and then they're like almost conveniently forgotten. But like they're almost just like little obstacles that are put in your way that complicate the overall narrative. But are satisfying to get over in the moment for a while. But then you get into day 3, part 2, and it's like, Jesus fucking Christ,
this will never end. I mean, especially even when you know that you're close to the end, you're like, it's got to wrap up soon. Come on, guys. Yeah,
I'm cross-examining Gant.
It's so much. But like overall, though, the series as a whole, or at least this installment of the series, I can't say the whole series because I'm only, you know, like most of the way through the second game at this point. I have not played all of them. But it has a very good tendency of just setting up a lot of characters that you either really passionately are like, I hate this character, or, you know, you might be kind of lukewarm on him, but like you feel some kind of way about them, and you draw some assumptions about them from how they are presented that they either turn on their head or lean into real hard, depending on the situation. And the characters that you end up liking, it's almost always like they come on real strong at first, and You don't know what to think about them, but then over time, you just, they kind of grow on you because they are so silly.
Yeah.
It, in that way, I think it has a lot of resonance to Danganronpa in that way, except in Danganronpa, they push it up to like, you know, if this game goes to, you know, 11, then that game puts it to like 29.
Yeah.
So it becomes like too much in Danganronpa. But in this game, it works to its advantage, I think, to where you end up having a fondness, to where I feel a fondness for the pain prosecutor Payne, who's like the tutorial dude, and like the fact that he shows back up again for 5 minutes in every game, like, you know, it's like, oh yeah, here we go, and you have like a kind of warm feeling about that, seeing those characters recur. So
yeah, you know, and something that I like about the spirit of the game is really summed up, you know, the one good thing about case number five, not to take it back to that, but this is a broader summary, is the way that, you know, Phoenix is the defense attorney. And then Miles, who, you know, is off of, I keep calling him Miles. Everybody calls him Edgeworth, who, you know, has finally kind of uncomplicated his relationship as a prosecutor, the way that they almost team up, in order to like get at the truth together by batting things back and forth. We're not going to get that because Edgeworth is going to be a little bit backseated as we go on to other prosecutors. Every entry in the series has its own set of prosecutors, but like the way that that those two characters play off of each other, and actually like what's important is, you know, getting at the truth and making sure that the right person sees justice for this, it ultimately like gets to this really good natured kind of side of the series that, you know, does begin every chapter with the murder and has a lot of people doing, you know, kind of shitty things. It could be far bleaker than it actually is, based even just on the summary, but it is, you know, just this you know, kind of bright and affirming thing in the final kind of analysis, right?
Yeah, and definitely Edgeworth, when he starts to do things that are contrary to his position as a prosecutor, because he honestly wants to make sure that the correct person is being, you know, found guilty. When that started to happen, that's when I started to actually really like, because I was like, eh, okay, he's maybe not the worst character. Yeah. And then like when he started doing that, I'm like, okay, he's a solid bro. Okay, fine. You know, he's still stuffy, and I would give him a lot of crap if I knew him as an actual person. Yeah. But like, yeah, okay, he's actually, he's a solid bro in there somewhere. Okay, yeah. We're cool. And that when that happens back and forth, when you've got the prosecutor and the defense attorney both, you know, working together and challenging each other in order to find the truth, that's you know, like a great thought-provoking kind of way to even have any kind of discussion if you're having a nice normal discussion with a person. So yeah. I liked that as an element in a courtroom setting, where like some of the witnesses will be like, aren't you the prosecutor, what are you doing? And he's just like, just answer the question, you know, like, just like, no, it doesn't matter. And that's because he says at the end of the game, like, he really wanted to be a defense attorney. He actually only became a prosecutor just to antagonize himself.
Yeah.
You know, because of the stuff that you unravel about the DL6 incident or whatever. but he actually at heart is more of a defense attorney.
That is a funny element, you know, because you know, from real life, you know, I tend to not like prosecutors, you know, just because I've got the political views that I have. Like, oh, they put a lot of innocent people in jail. But like in this world, the fact that every prosecutor is a fucking supervillain who would only take that job because, you know, they have some horrible flaw at the heart of them. And every defense attorney, at least the ones that we see, is like pure and good. Yeah. Like just the things that are taken as a matter of faith, just in order to have this shorthand for who you should trust and who you should not, is very funny to me.
Well, and I kept on saying throughout the time I was playing this game, I want Phoenix to have a guilty client. I want him to like actually, because this is just so convenient that every single one of his clients is absolutely innocent every time. Like, yeah. I'm sorry, that's not going to be the case. You're
going to get a version of that. So just to prime you for stuff coming down the line.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the spirit of this game, no. You know, overall for him to have a client like that, but it's just my nature to be like, that's a little too consistent. That's just too convenient that he's always got an innocent character yeah. for his client or whatever. So, but yeah, so this was a fun game to play. Mm-hmm. I did have some hard times with some of the characters, particularly when I got to Salmonella. That was probably the nadir of this game for me, because I was just like, his animations, if you go look him up, he's got this weird, gross, tongue waggly thing going, and he's like weird and like the kind of gropey, gross character that you just don't want anywhere near anybody yeah. that you know. Like, mm-hmm. no, it's yeah. not. And luckily he's not the most important character in that mm-hmm. particular case, but he's still pretty unsavory to have pop up in there in this otherwise fairly lighthearted for the dark subject matter kind of game that yeah. it is.
Thankfully, Salmonella does not recur. They don't think, yeah, let's add him to the stable here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Well, this was fun. I'm really sorry that it took me so long to play this and get up to speed.
You've been a busy person, and I definitely had to do some homework and rewatch some things to remember yeah. because I was like, didn't I play this a year ago? And it wasn't quite that far. I think yeah. it was like July or August that mm-hmm. I was playing it.
Yeah.
So it wasn't quite that long ago, but mm-hmm. I've definitely slept since then, and I did do some rewatching of some Let's Plays and mm-hmm. you know, speed it up so I could, you know, read through the text and
yeah.
go about my business. Definitely had to be with no commentary, though. I cannot. Oh, I
yeah.
cannot.
Yeah, that's tough.
Chatter.
So, but yeah, the next one will not be as long. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So this was fun, and this is our new format for this kind of a thing. We'll try to do the generalities and a spoiler wall mm-hmm. going forward for all of these, because it's a little tricky, because if it's more of a pure visual novel, there's so much more story than there is mechanics and other stuff to talk about. But yes. we'll do our best.
Yeah, yeah. So. You know, and we're open to we're open to feedback on that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why we have the spoiler wall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So hope you all enjoyed this.
Yep. See you next time.
Bye-bye.